Welcome to After Hours at the Radio Book Club. It is a podcast that's a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. And today we're talking with author Matthew Sullivan. His book, Midnight at the Bright Ideas Bookstore. It is set in Denver at a fictionalized bookstore that we're all completely aware is the Tattered Cover in Lodo in Denver. And what reaction have you had from the Tattered Cover and fellow booksellers there?
Right. It's been positive across the board, really, as far as I know. No, it really has been wonderful. I think that the Kathy Langer, who is a longtime book buyer at the Tattered Cover, said that when the galley came across her desk, or when she heard that a former bookseller was having this book published, and it was a very not so thinly veiled version of Tattered Cover, she said that she had a bit of a pause, like, is this going to be some kind of tell-all scandalous inside story of the Tattered Cover or something like that? But of course it isn't at all. It's really, I was setting out to celebrate the Tattered Cover and celebrate independent bookstores and book lovers. And so I hope that becomes clear, you know.
I find it an homage to, bookstores and Denver as well. Yeah. I mean, I thought it was written very sympathetically from a perspective of somebody who has a real appreciation.
Yeah. I mean, that was the intent. It really was supposed to be an homage. So,
although it is interesting, you could write a real life account of the Tattered Cover and you could think it's fiction because they've had so many interesting adventures as a bookstore in and of themselves.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was telling Matthew when we were talking earlier that the booksellers at our store, for the most part, have loved it. But there's a couple booksellers that have problems with it. And I think part of their problems with it might stem not really from the book itself, but part of this view of bookselling, because it is somewhat romanticized and idealized. And I think for some of the people who are in the trenches, especially maybe some of our managers, and they're like, I don't think that would fly at our store. Like, what do you mean? There's one scene where Lydia is given a list of books where she's supposed to pull them to send back to the publishers, which all bookstores have to do. Like otherwise our shelves would explode and we'd run out of money. So you have to pull off the books that aren't selling and send them back. But Lydia, she's not even asked to do it anymore because she just can't bring herself to take the books off the shelves. And so a manager at our store facing somebody like this would pull their hair out. Like, just do that to pull the books off. But we do feel like Lydia does in a way. Like, oh, I like this book. And as the buyer, when I'm in that situation, sometimes I'm like, am I the only person in Boulder that liked this book? I'm the one who bought it. I put it on the shelf and now I have to send it back. But Lydia is somebody who actually refuses to do it. So I think that there is kind of those romanticized views of bookselling.
Well, and then the romanticizing of, you know, the people who are coming into the store. Yeah. And I wonder, has that changed? Because this book is set in the 90s. Mm-hmm. We're in a situation now where, I mean, I know Boulder Public Library had to get extra security because mm-hmm. there were concerns about people who were coming in, who, you know, because there are very few facilities for people who are on the margins, and whether they're dealing with substance issues or mental health or, you know, lack of resources, mm-hmm. The perfect storm of all of those. We're seeing that played out in places like libraries and often mm-hmm. bookstores as well. And particularly because you're so inviting, you have mm-hmm. little sofas and little nooks and little seats you could just curl up with a book.
Yeah,
but then if you have people who are curling up with a book because they have nowhere else to go, Lydia and the other booksellers are very, very sympathetic.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a situation where they're going, I wish that person would leave, but I'm sure the reality is maybe a little bit starker.
Yeah, and I think it has to do with the level of disruption, probably. I mean, to be absolutely clear, this is a highly idealized version of Tattered Cover. In some ways, it's highly idealized. I think in a lot of ways, it's actually realistic, but it's coming out of my imagination and maybe in that same kind of way that I'm nostalgic about Denver or Colorado, I'm also nostalgic about the bookstore. So, but you know, I worked at another bookstore in Boston for a couple of years. And like I said, I work at a community college where we have an open door policy and we have, you know, my wife is a librarian. And so she's dealing with issues like this all the time in the library there. And I guess there's, in my mind, when I think back, there was a level of benevolence to the public at the Tattered Cover in particular that I just have never experienced in most businesses, most associations, most organizations that I've been associated with. Not that it was, you know, come in and do whatever you want or anything like that. But I think when you have people who are gravitating toward the world of books are making a particular choice, and booksellers in particular are making a choice, and it brings in people like we were talking about earlier, who are maybe more open-minded, and not that there aren't misanthropes among us, because there are, but who maybe see that connection, that kind of empathy to others, that also comes out of, you know, having empathy when we read. You know, the connections between empathy and literature are clear, right? You know, we feel empathy when we're reading in a way that maybe we don't in other activities in our life. And so maybe there's a connection there. People who are drawn to books and people who are booksellers are generally more idealistic, I think, and more empathetic, I think, than others. So maybe that's why there's a little bit more wiggle room in terms of policies and that kind of thing. Is, you know, of course, I can think of instances where we had asked people to leave, and you know, I've talked before about you know, having to chase people who are stealing books, which went against all policies at Tattercover. We were not supposed to do that, but that was one of the origin stories of this book, was me chasing a guy who was one of these kind of marginalized characters who was stealing a bunch of books. Me and another bookseller ended up chasing him all the way down the 16th Street Mall and taking the books back and looking at the books. And these were titles that this guy would never read. He was in the store all the time. We kind of knew him. He was welcome in the store, and he kind of turned around and stole a bunch of books. And so part of that situation,
that's like a social contract being just broken.
Yeah,
right there.
It's hard.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a decent amount of shoplifting in the book industry, and it's very demoralizing for the staff.
That's interesting to me, because mm-hmm. they're big and bulky. I mean, where do you hide them? Do you know what I mean? I mean, yeah. Just from a practical shoplifting sense.
Yeah, this guy had a trench coat on, and it was kind of like the, you know, that old scene, the cliche scene of the guy in the grocery store with the trench coat, who's got a turkey and a ham, and, you know, packing it in. He had packed in books in his pants and his shirt and sleeves, and really he'd found ways.
And that has got to be demoralizing, because we've talked so much about how certain people gravitate towards being in bookstores, whether they're working there or whether mm-hmm. they're, you know, customers. And so yeah. you gravitate towards that because you have this, and I don't want to use the word idealistic, mm-hmm. you know, view, but you have a real passion for books. And then to have to deal with that nasty side of it, to deal be security, or to have to mm-hmm. eject people for different reasons, that seems to be the complete opposite.
Yeah.
Of, you know, most people who are working there.
Yeah, it's the hardest thing we do. And when that alarm goes off, we have a whole training about how do you, you know, alarm goes off for many reasons. And often it's not somebody stealing a book, so you don't want to accuse people. But at the same time, you need to react to it. And there is a temptation to run. I've run after a couple people over the years, you know, even though you're not supposed to. But
and why are you not supposed to? Because it sounds like this
hurt.
Is a real standard,
you know,
policy
it's
in bookstores.
It's not worth risking one of your employees' lives for $50 worth of books. That doesn't make sense. You don't know what's going to happen once you get outside of the store and somebody who's really desperate turns on you. You don't know. And we've called people. We've brought people back to the office, and then we call the police, and they'll wait for the police, and then the police come, and the police pat them down, and all sorts of things have come out of their pockets, you know, and so you don't want to put your employees in danger. Somehow, when you're in the position of a manager like I am, somehow you, in the heat of the moment, you think you're somehow exempt. I don't know, but you know, I haven't done that for a while. I'm a little older now, but yeah. Certainly in my 20s, you know, like, I'm going to get those books back.
Yeah, and not even in the situation that I'm thinking of, there wasn't even a question. It wasn't anything that we deliberated. It was like, guy stealing books, get him, and just ran after him, not thinking about the policy that we had learned in the binder, you know. I think.
Yeah, but it just takes one incident, and that's a big mistake, so yeah. You don't want that to happen.
And the first chapter of this book originally was kind of a retelling of that, where Lydia's sitting on a bench on the 16th Street Mall, and a guy comes out of the store packed with books, and she goes after him, chasing him, and the suicide was him jumping in front of one of the shuttle buses on the 16th Street Mall. And I think that I ended up scrapping that chapter. Well, I don't think that. I know I ended up scrapping that chapter. But in my mind, the way that Joey in the opening chapter here commit suicide is more kind of in line with the rest of the book. But that's really where the spark for this entire story came from.
When you write about something like suicide that's so tragic,
yeah,
I mean, what kind of process do you go through to make sure that you're using the appropriate language, that you're not making something sensational that is such a, you know, a reality for so many people? I mean, there's a lot of sensitivity, I'm sure, that comes with writing a scene like that.
Yeah, and I guess I think about it from a writer's perspective. For me, everything is about character, and it's about kind of the emotional and psychological lives of characters. And so when tragic events happen to those characters, that it needs to ring true, and it needs to ring true not just in the kind of event itself, but in the emotional reaction to that event and the reasons that lead up to that event. And I guess I would, I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I thought Joey was the one who committed suicide ends up being a remarkable character. And when you hear his whole story as it gets played out in pieces throughout the book, you really feel for him in a deep way. And I thought you did an excellent job with that. I mean, it's always hard to write about suicide, but then you're also, as a writer, you've got to convince the reader that this person felt that was the only option available.
Right. You know? Right. And a lot of this, I think, with Lydia's character, too, this is about the ripple effects of tragic events. And so there's the ripple effects of Joey's suicide that impact other people. There's the ripple effects of what happened to Lydia when she's 10 years old that impact the entire story. And I think if for me, that's at the core of everything in this book. And if I got that right, then hopefully everything else becomes more believable, that those events resonate, and they resonate outward, and they impact people on a personal, psychological level.
One of the things I liked very much, and I think is very real to how we live our lives, is the past is always with us. Those ripples are always there. And so Lydia has what happened with the Hammer Man, the murder that she witnessed as a young child. Her father's dealing with that. They're not that far beneath the surface of the present. Mm-hmm. And so the ripples from Joey's suicide meet these constant ripples from the Hammer Man past. Mm-hmm. And that tension of those kind of ripples coming together is where you get the book, it seemed to me.
Right, right. And I think with her father, Tomas, in particular, Lydia ends up on one trajectory, and how she deals with that. He ends up on a very different trajectory, and be careful with spoilers here, but toward the end of the book, she discovers that he has kind of created this, what I think of as like a depraved version of a library. Like he was trying to kind of get back to the happiness that he felt when he was a librarian back in Denver before this event occurred. And that in the way that he was kind of reckoning with that, he ended up with this kind of alternate reality along the Continental Divide, in this cabin that's like this, like, again, this kind of depraved library.
He was almost entombed by the books as opposed to being healed by the books.
And it's like it was like a wrongful interpretation of what happened, or a wrongful reckoning with what happened, whereas Lydia found bright ideas and moved toward healing in that way. It's like her dad got caught in this depraved loop.
That idea of how books can impact people in positive ways, that sense that you get when you walk into a bookstore, particularly I think in independent bookstore like the Tattered Cover, the Boulder Bookstore, it's so well curated. There's so much thought, there's so much passion in that. And that's why I have always felt so sad about when people don't have a book buying experience that's part of that. It's completely different just going online, going onto the website that we all know that we're not going to mention, and just clicking, and here's my credit card, and off you go. To me, that's such a betrayal of the entire experience that you get to have with the book. And then if you have it on a digital device, and I know a lot of people love Kindles, and I know a lot of people love that, but to me, just the tangible aspect of going into a bookstore, looking at the covers, experiencing that, there's so many more aspects to it than ultimately reading text.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm a kind of old fashioned in that way too. Whereas a book is an artifact and it's something that we hold, and the smell of it and the feel of the pages, all of that is really important to me as well. And you can't you can't do what Arson does with an algorithm. Period.
Can you, Arson? Can we replace you with an algorithm?
Well, if you find it, I'll start using it, but not tell anybody, and then maybe I can just go to sleep.
You can take a week off.
I can just go to sleep underneath my desk. No, I mean, I like to think that, you know, I've been in Boulder for 25 years now, and I try to pick out books that, you know, are small gems and that maybe would work in this community that don't work in other places. And we have the whole staff does. It's not just about me. It's about it's about the whole staff writing recommendations and all these different ideas coming. And I like, you were talking about empathy in books, you know, and books, I feel like, connect people directly to other people in a way that it's almost impossible in any other medium. Like you're hearing from somebody else's mind directly when you read the page in a very powerful way. And I really believe in the humanity of that and being able to talk to people about that and being, you know, just and being in it with other people. Yeah, I go to Chicago. I have my favorite used bookstore and, you know, the books are cluttered. It doesn't look anything like Boulder Bookstore. You know, everything's spined out and it's tiny, but and you brush shoulders against people. But there's something about that human sense about buying it. And, you know, and I met Matthew at an event at Lodo. It was before the book came out. And it was booksellers from the Mountains and Plains region who were are kind of there for some meetings. And then in the evening, there was some authors came to talk about their books. And it was very, you know, Matthew kind of, you could see how thrilled he was to be back in a tatter cover with a book. You
seem, and tripped out.
Yeah, you were kind of tripped out. And, and some of your old colleagues from all those years ago were there. And the booksellers were just having this human connection with the authors. And so, yeah, I mean, you could say a book is a book. But there are this other side of it that I think is really critical and that is important to my life, and it's nice to hear you say it's important to you, Maeve and Matthew. And I think that's why stores like Tatter Cover and Boulder Bookstore are still around. There are enough people that still think that way.
And you know, if you think, and I'm talking about connecting this to something quite grim, I suppose, talking about the tragic events that happened when Lydia was a child, and just, I suppose, Joey's entire tragic existence. He had a terrible childhood. Books that you read when you're a child impact you in huge ways as well. I mean, I remember the first books, I think it was in second grade, that I really became aware that I was able to read on my own without that I was able to get lost in. They're still my favorite, like Anne of Green Gables. I adore, and I have the whole collection ready for my oldest daughter to come of age. Well, I will inflict it on her, and God help her if she doesn't love it as much as I do. But when you're a child, the books that you're introduced to are so influential, I think, in your life as well.
I think about reading Kurt Vonnegut for the first time when I was in high school, reading Breakfast of Champions, and it just blew my mind. I was like, what is this guy doing? And then, you know, from that, getting into that leapfrog where it's like, okay, Vonnegut wrote this, and then he also wrote this, and just reading on, going on this kind of rampage of gathering all the Vonnegut books that I could and getting caught up in them. And I would have never become an English major. I never would have become a writer if I didn't kind of stumble upon, not necessarily that book, but him and Tom Robbins and a lot of books that I was just kind of discovering outside of the classroom. And not that, you know, reading The Outsiders in the classroom was wonderful and impactful too, but I think those things that we kind of stumble upon that you can't, things that you can stumble upon, titles that you can stumble upon in a bookstore that you can't or wouldn't if it was on a screen, you know?
Well, in your book, Joey's delivering secret messages through books. And, you know, I didn't list them all, but I was wondering, is this your secret list of books? You know, included on there was Geek Love, which is kind of a cult favorite. Sula, a Walker Percy book, The Last Gentleman, which he's what really goes on for him is a moviegoer. So The Last Gentleman's kind of a second book of his in a way. So that's like a hidden gem there. But then you had Alice in Wonderland. So I was wondering, when you were putting those books in there, was it a little, you know...
Some of these were absolute favorites or favorite authors. Like there's some references to Borges in there, who I love, and Paul Auster's New York trilogy is one of my all-time favorites. And so, yes, they're personal. But I also found myself kind of thinking about Lydia and just who she is as a character and trying to filter it through there. But just on a kind of a practical level, when I'm sitting there and writing, and I have bookshelves around me with the books that I've kept and hung on to, a lot of it is that, like, oh, that book, you know, just kind of not that it's random, but because it's in my sight, it has a certain life that something that I maybe borrowed from a library and gave back doesn't. Mm-hmm. And again, it comes back to that book as artifact, and you have to be very careful in that realm not to become a hoarder, right?
There's a fine line, I think. I keep being accused of being a hoarder of books by my husband, and I'm like, no, because there's so much more than just a book. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's really hard if you're not paying for them. When I get sent like five good books a week, I'm like, how am I not going to take those five great
you
books?
You could kind of use books as furniture, maybe right. walls or, you know, incorporate need, them into
there's
your...
There's a way we can sit on these books for dinner. We don't need our chairs anymore.
Right.
How do you decompress after writing something like this? Because you said it was a long process and it was mm-hmm. a much longer book originally.
Yeah.
And there are some dark storylines in there, but there's also, like, there's the mystery. I mean, my adrenaline was going up. I think because I read it so... In very short sittings, I couldn't put it down after two sittings, it was done. And so how do you as a writer, having spent so much time, decompress from something like this?
I think, again, it's fairly practical, in part because, you know, I teach full time. And so when I'm writing, I'm just squeezing in whatever time I can. And so I decompress by running down and cooking dinner for my kids, you know,
because going to work.
Going to work. I mean, really, there's in some ways, you know, the emotional decompression, I think comes there. There is an element of I don't want to say callous, but something that maybe like a scene, you know, like a murder scene or something like that. That's really emotionally charged for me. The 10th or 20th time that I'm revising it, it does lose some of that impact, even though it's still there. When I think about it, the words and the process itself almost become separate. And it's kind of interesting. I don't know if other writers experience this, but I look at this book and I'm like, God, I guess I kind of remember writing that. You know, not the obviously like the it's the whole thing, but individual scenes, I know they're in there. I know why they're in there. I know them well. But when I think about the process, it's all kind of in a way, it's a blur.
But are you on to your next writing project?
Yeah. I'm working on another book and another kind of literary mystery. And this one is set in a small lake town in the in central Washington, which is very desolate and very underpopulated. And
is there a bookstore?
No, there's not. I'm not going to do the bookstore.
Could you do a
series.
Little library? Maybe you could have one of those little libraries somewhere.
You at least
there.
Have a bookshelf somewhere.
Right.
Yeah, the free libraries.
The free little library thing.
Yeah, right.
You can find a clue.
Could use one, actually, yeah. So no, it's not another bookstore book, but another literary mystery. And I'm trying to bend some rules and keep it interesting for me. I guess.
Well, we look forward to reading that
cool,
when it comes
you.
Of age. Awesome. In the meantime, Matthew Sullivan has been our guest after hours at the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and at the Boulder Bookstore. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.